From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later on, the secrets of the 12,000-year-old Göbekli Tepe in Turkey. An amazing story. Here's what's happening. While Iran seems to be trying to flex its muscles, Iran says it will target U.S. aircraft carriers based in the Persian Gulf if a war were to ever erupt between the two countries. Iran is currently building a replica of the USS Nimitz aircraft carrier, which will be used in future military exercises. The Revolutionary Guards Navy has already targeted mock-up U.S. warships, according to some Iranians, adding that it only took 50 seconds to destroy one of them. Try doing that for real. Russia's foreign minister has ruled out holding fresh talks in Geneva to defuse the Ukrainian crisis unless pro-Russian opposition groups are involved. Meanwhile, the problems, the fighting, everything continues there. As the earthquake debate continues, the U.S. Geological Survey and the Oklahoma Geological Survey says that oil and natural gas activity is a likely contributing factor to the swarm of earthquakes throughout the state over the past few years, and that the risk of a huge earthquake is growing. The rate of earthquakes in the state has jumped about 50% since October. Let's check in with Earth Changes Media, Mitch Batras. Mitch, this is a tense situation there.
Well, yes, it is, George. What happened is many of the people who work at the USGS said enough is enough. You know, basically it's a battle between the scientists and the oil people. And it is fracking. I don't even post Oklahoma earthquakes. You know, it has nothing to do with natural occurrences. This is nothing more than water being shot down these drilling holes. It's called fracking, pressurized water that goes through these drill holes, and it could pose a danger. I mean, finally the USGS stands up and says, "Okay, you want to play this game? We're going to go public," and now they have. And now with people having a concern of it escalating to 5.0, which could happen, it would be man-made.
Oh, disastrous. And you and I don't believe in man-made climate change, but we do agree on man-made earthquakes.
Well, that's right. We certainly do. And I'll tell you one thing that it does support. It does support my theory that I've talked to you about over the years. It's called fluid displacement. Which is a natural occurrence,
for example,
on a lunar eclipse or even in the time of solar eclipse, more with lunar because it has to do with the shifting of tides and water, fluid, not just water, but oil and any kind of fluid. And when that fluid displaces, whether it increase or decrease, well, that puts pressure or releases pressure on plate tectonics, and that causes earthquakes.
All right, Mitch, thank you so much. Climate change, by the way, is having significant financial, ecological, and human health impacts across the U.S., according to a new report. The third National Climate Assessment released by the White House says that the number and strength of extreme weather events have increased over the past 50 years. Infrastructure is being damaged by sea level rise, downpours, and extreme heat. The report says these impacts are likely to worsen in the coming decades. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration questioned the value of taking aspirin to try to ward off a first heart attack or stroke in people who have never had cardiovascular problems. The FDA statement follows its decision last week to turn down a request by German drug maker Bayer to change the labeling on packages in order to market aspirin's value in preventing heart attacks in people who have never had this disease. Christian Wild, of course, author of Hidden Causes of Heart Attack and Stroke, with us. What do you think of this? Just simply saying, don't take aspirin if you haven't had a problem.
Mm-hmm. We got a whole new paradigm, George. In 1990, the FDA approved aspirin for protection against the second heart attack. But many physicians, certainly most of us listening tonight, have probably asked ourselves, from a common sense standpoint, if aspirin can help prevent a second heart attack, why wouldn't it make sense to also take it as a preventive, protecting against the first heart attack or even a stroke? And if there is little added risk, because it would still be worth it to avoid a heart attack. But as we know, modern medicine and politics do not make determinations based on common sense. There's also the concern of brain bleeds and stomach bleeds, particularly among those who have any form of an ulcer. Now, that blood clotting process itself is a complicated balancing act. We've talked about it before. It involves a whole cascade, George, of factors that regulate the clotting process. Aspirin is one that moderates and regulates one of the pathways affecting the sticking of platelets together. It's called platelet aggregation. Now, the FDA, because of concerns of this internal bleeding, has revisited the issue. There's also been a study, I think we talked about it at one time, that investigated a heightened risk of bleeding in the eyes if someone has a diagnosis of macular degeneration. So there was a warning on that. But while we're discussing aspirin and platelet aggregation, there's also the concern of hypercoagulation or blood viscosity, which is different from platelet aggregation. It's a completely different risk factor for heart attack and stroke. As example, if someone received a wound or a cut or sustained any serious break in the skin without the right amount of fibrin or fibrinogen to seal the bleeding, we would literally bleed out.
That's right.
Thinning fibrinogen's clotting mechanism is also one of the main factors besides platelet aggregation. And certainly anyone with von Willebrand, which is factor 13, would bleed to death because they have a problem in clotting in the first place.
So we're down to this. Do you or do you not take the little baby 82 milligram aspirin?
That's a good question, and that's one where each one of us will have to decide with your doctor. But I think, you know, I got a feeling what you and I might do, but we'll just let the physician and the patient have that conversation.
Christian's website, myheartbook.com, toll-free number if you don't have a computer. If you want more information on what he does, 1-800-866-STEM-123. It's that simple, 1-800-866-STEM-123. In a moment, what is going on Mount Shasta in Northern California? And have you ever heard of the Greek name Archon? What does that mean? Up next, Jay Widener joins us next on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast. Let me tell you a little bit about Jay Widener, of course. He is a filmmaker. He's a writer. He spent more than 30 years researching alchemy, ancient traditions. He's written a couple books and also has an incredible film on Shasta coming out. He's made more than 25 documentaries with his company, Sacred Mysteries, and he studies the films of Stanley Kubrick. And here he is back on Coast to Coast. Jay, how are you?
Hey, I'm good, George. How are you?
Looking forward to this. I want to talk with you for a little bit about archons, and then we'll get into your new film, Shasta.
Sure.
What is an archon?
Well, archon is, it's a Greek word, like you pointed out so astutely, that actually means ruler. But the archon that we're kind of talking about comes from the Nag Hammadi texts, which were discovered in Egypt in 1945. By a kid looking for a goat in went into a cave, and they're in clay jars. And the reason that the Nag Hammadi is so important is because it hasn't been censored by Pope or King or President or anybody. So we kind of have an idea of what people 2,100 years ago were thinking without anybody getting in the way of it. And there's a chapter in the Nag Hammadi called The Hypostasis of the Archons. And in there, they warn about an off-planet spiritual parasite is the best way I can put it, that has come and invaded Earth. And it gets into the minds of people who make wrong decisions, unethical decisions, you might say. When they make these decisions, these archons, these spiritual parasites, in their weakened spiritual state, they attack them. And once you've got an archon in you, it gets real hard to get them out of you. And we all know people probably who seem to be non-empathic, unable to react to emotions the way that other people do, who are manipulative, who say things that they don't mean, who take things that aren't theirs. And, you know, and these people can frequently work their way up to the top of organizations, corporations, and the military, and religions. And I think it's, you know, the Nag Hammadi is pretty explicit that they're here and that we have to worry about them. Now, here's the thing that's so important to remember, is that all the groups that have come down to us through history who talked about the Archons have been wiped out. Systematically. They were called the Gnostics, and they were wiped pretty much off the face of the earth, to the extent that if you took a religious studies course in a college today, you wouldn't even have even a mention of the Gnostics. They've been pretty much written right out of history. And they're starting to make a comeback now, but with the works of John Lash, for instance. But, you know, still there's very few people that know much about any of this. The Nag Hammadi is what has given birth to this return to Gnosticism and what that means, but also to the knowledge of the Archons. And as people examine the Archons and what it says about them in the Nag Hammadi, we realize that the whole point of the Archons is to create a false culture of fear, because they live off of fear.
They thrive on it. Now, would they be considered false gods, Jay?
Yeah, that's what the Gnostics said. They're false gods. They pose as gods, and then they create situations where as much agony and bloodshed as possible can be, you know, bled out of the situation. A lot. If you look at what's going on in Ukraine right now. It's, you know, if you look at the world leaders, it's almost as if they fomented a plot to just create as much chaos in that place as possible. It's a perfect example of how the Archons work. And now we have, you know, brother against brother and neighbor against neighbor, which is, you know, the Archons' favorite situation. And this is going on in a lot of other places on Earth and has been going on for a long time. The Gnostics would tell us that this was not going on before the Archon invasion of about 3,500 to maybe 6,000 years ago. It was a different kind of humanity. And it's actually the cause of all of our strife, is this problem.
These Archons, Jay, sound almost like they're devils.
Well, they are. I think that the demon, the mythology of demons, the mythology of the kind of the sorcerers and the black magicians and even the devil himself comes from this idea of the Archons. And the rumors are that they can pose as humans even and work their way up into power. And that's why they were called the rulers by the Greek. It's really interesting is that if you take the word anarchy or anarchist, it actually means against the Archons, as if anarchy would be against the rulers. So it's very interesting to start taking the Greek language and looking at what it is trying to tell you about the Archons.
What are they after, Jay? Are they after souls, or what do they want?
Yeah, I think so. I think that what they want is they want to convince you first that you don't have a soul. That's their first goal, because then you're easier to get. And so they spend a lot of time trying to convince the humans that we're really not very important, because you see the Archons do not have a soul, so they're extremely jealous of us because we do, and they kind of have a game where we have to be they will tell us what they're doing. They're actually all these things that we see, like the Lone Gunman episode about 9/11 and all that. This is a part of the game where they have to tell us what they're doing in some way, and then we have to tacitly agree to the Archon's plan. And this has been going on for a long time, for a few thousand years, but now in the age of internet and coast to coast and things like that, this game is starting to break down, and we're starting to realize, you know, that we've been had by forces that maybe are not human even.
Can these Archons be right under our noses and we wouldn't know it?
Yes, they can be. However, again, via the internet, we're like really trying to, we're really starting to figure out their game. So we're also beginning to figure out their traits. And you know, psychologists and psychiatrists would refer to them not as Archons but as psychopaths. And so in that way, we can kind of look at what science and psychiatry is saying about psychopathic behavior, and you can realize that it actually emulates and completely correlates with what the ancients were saying is archonic behavior.
Well, then you're right, though. They're in politics, too.
Yeah, I mean, they're everywhere. I can't even watch politics anymore because everybody, no matter what side of the aisle they're on, all I see and hear is Archons. And I know they're not going to do what we want because they're doing the Archon agenda, not the agenda of the people.
So they thrive on chaos, I assume.
Yes, they love chaos and pain and all the negativity that they can generate. They feed us food. It's like dinner. It's like going out to the best restaurant in town, and they thrive off of it. And all sorts of events, violent sporting events, violent movies, horror movies. These are all our kind of inventions of the Archons to generate as much negativity as possible. And if you can imagine a movie theater in the 70s when they were showing The Exorcist, you know, must have been a lot of negative, scary energy coming out of all those theaters.
So how do we fight them off, Jay?
That's the million-dollar question, and everybody asks it. And I think what we have to do is first recognize there's a problem, then recognize that there are people, or maybe not people, who are out there who are exhibiting traits that are contrary to human ethics, you might say. They easily lie, they easily steal and cheat and work their way up to the top. They're charismatic, superficially only though. And I think once we recognize these traits, we're going to start recognizing them. And I think they know that because recently there's been an upsurge in this kind of knowledge, especially equating Archons with psychopaths. And so now we're getting a lot of movies and things which are trying to show us that psychopaths are actually cute and cuddly and you know, we should you know, have some empathy for them, even though they have no empathy for us.
Are they human?
It's a good question because Robert Hare, who is a psychiatrist in Vancouver, British Columbia, he claims that there is actually a brain difference between psychopaths or Archons and regular humans, and only
that's
about 4% of the human race is this group of people, and so I say, okay, if our definition of a human, to me, anyway, my definition of a human is an animal who possesses consciousness and empathy for the beings around it and wants to help.
And maybe has a soul.
Has a soul, exactly. I think those things emanate from the soul, actually. And so if I find that there's people, 4%, who have absolutely 0% ability to empathize and have 0% ability to be conscious, I have to begin wondering if they are human.
Stay with us. We're going to come back with Jay Widener in just a moment. We're going to talk about his new feature film called Shasta. It's an incredible film, incredible story. His websites are linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. So if you have a minute, go ahead and take a look at that. He's got a few up there for you. And if you need to email me, that's george@coasttocoastam.com. And you can get to our website now also by just going C2, that's the number, C2CAM.com. Makes it easy for you. Put it up there in your favorites list, and you'll have it there. It'll be really easy. We'll be back in a moment. We're going to talk about Mount Shasta next on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast, Jay Widener with us. I cannot tell you how many times when I do open lines, somebody calls and checks in from Mount Shasta or about Mount Shasta in Northern California, a very mystical area. Jay Widener has done a film on this called Shasta. Jay, tell me a little bit about how you put this together. It's an amazing place.
It is. I was living about an hour north at the time that I wrote the screenplay and, began becoming interested in Shasta for the few years I lived near it and started reading a lot of the lore about it. And it was kind of amazing going back all the way to when the white people first came and the Indians told them that, you know, the Shining Ones live up on Mount Shasta. And then I started exploring Mount Shasta and talking to the residents that lived around Mount Shasta. And there's these huge lava tubes that go out in all directions underneath Mount Shasta. They're huge. Some are as big as tall as cathedrals. And they're huge. They run miles, and they're everywhere. And I began, you know, not exactly exploring them because not really a spelunker, but, you know, going in there and trying to decide, you know, whether I would use some of this in a film that I was planning about Mount Shasta. And, you know, I talked to the people and they talked about, you know, strange beings walking around in the woods and, people coming into town and buying stuff and paying for it with gold. And, you know, shoelaces with a gold coin, you know, a $300 gold coin. And, so I got really kind of interested in the lore. And, you know, there's books that have been bestsellers about Mount Shasta. There's, rumors, there's UFO sightings all the time, there's Bigfoot sightings all the time. The place is permeated with this stuff. And that became my fascination. So then I decided to put together a film that sort of would touch on all the things that are weird about Mount Shasta, plus, you know, tell an entertaining story. In which, by the way, the Archons are the bad guys.
Absolutely. Is it, because I've never been there, is it a big area?
Well, it's daunting. You can see it for like 100 miles as you go north up 5 or come down from 5 from Seattle. And, you know, you can see it first. It's just this white little kind of hill. And then it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger until you've got this gigantic mountain that is flooding the entire landscape. And, it's pointing right out of the plains. It's not like it's part of a range. It's like it's just sitting there all by itself. And it's a volcano. And, you can see lots of odd things if you hike around Mount Shasta, strange shafts in between rocks and things.
Huh.
There's what I think is going on is that the I don't know if there's aliens there or not. Like everybody says there's some kind of base underneath the mountain in a city called Telos, and that might be true. But what I think is going on is that there's a lot of life, cryptozoology kind of life, living in the lava tubes and coming out at night.
Unusual life?
Yeah, I think unusual stuff that we don't see nocturnal. And hikers, and you know, in the early morning hours or in the early evening hours will stumble upon some of these creatures, and it will really freak you out, let me tell you. And Bigfoot being a primary one,
yeah.
That's his primary where his sightings are. But I think others, too, things that we just don't even know about. I've talked to several cryptozoologists about this, and they think that, you know, these tunnel systems under Mount Shasta really have to be explored more thoroughly.
There's no question that people have come back from Mount Shasta with incredible stories. What do you think has created the mysticism, Jay, about that area?
Well, I don't know. I it's been there from the start, and I can only say that you know, where there's smoke, there's fire. So if they want to say to us that there's a, you know, a group of lost humans who decided to, what you might call a relic population of humans, maybe, who maybe even evolved differently than we did,
mm-hmm.
and doesn't really want to be around us much. That's the what the main beat of we hear, and that they're from Lemuria, and that they escaped some kind of catastrophe and went into Shasta. That's basically the lore. And if you have this lore, and then you go in and you find these incredibly huge and long lava tubes, which who knows how far down they run. They might be, you know, 30 or 40 stories of it going down into the ground. No one's really looked at very much. So once we have that, we have, you know, now we could have a place where someone actually could go, theoretically. And then, you know, the area is so remote that it could be extremely possible. The east side of Mount Shasta has nothing going for hundreds and hundreds of miles, literally nothing. No ranches, no farms, zero, just nothing. And anything could be going on out there.
How many people that are metaphysically inclined go there? I mean, is it packed?
Yeah, a lot of people do with the eclipse, the annular eclipse that we had a couple of years ago. It was jam-packed. And, you know, it's definitely got a charge. I mean, you go there and you can feel the vibe. And, you know, so when we made the movie, you know, we wanted to make sure we kind of captured all of the vibe of the whole thing, you know, and we wanted to make sure that we got in the Archons and the Lemurians and, you know, sacred geometry and the light body. I got Neil Donald Walsh to play Count Saint Germain. So he comes in and gives us his wisdom. And he's a perfect character actor for that part. And so we used all the lore because, you know, supposedly Count Saint Germain comes out of Mount Shasta and comes down into Shasta, Mount Shasta, the town, and has tea every once in a while. And people talk about him, you know, as 6'4", real handsome guy who, you know, never ages. And, you know, I don't know if any of this is true, but I just liked all the stories and decided I would try to get as much of it as I could into the film.
When people visit Mount Shasta and then they come back down, do they feel differently?
Yeah, they do. And some people, they can't handle it. There's even, you know, there's a 1938 article in the Los Angeles Times of the travel reporter takes a train to Mount Shasta. And you can read this online. This is an actual article in the Times where he says he sees a light. You know, there's a light that's shining at Mount Shasta at night. And so he gets off the train and he goes and he starts talking to the people in Mount Shasta. And they say, oh, that's the Lemurians, you know, doing their rituals at night. And this is a bona fide serious article. And then he talks about how the Lemurians occasionally come into town and teach people their sacred knowledge. And it's really kind of a jaw-dropping article that, you know, from a travel writer that's kind of hard to believe.
Jay, for people who want to watch this, is it a DVD? Is it going to be in, you know, a movie house? Where can they see it?
Yeah, it'll be, you know, at more of the artsy movie houses across United States and Europe. And we're doing a grassroots thing. The movie business, as you know, is falling all apart. And people are, especially distribution is just getting harder and
fragmented.
Harder. Even George Lucas's last film, he couldn't even get distributed, if you can believe that.
Yeah.
And so we're taking a different tack. You know, we're going more towards our market, which is a more of a spiritual market. And we're going to, so you'll be in theaters, and then we're going to release it on, you know, either like Vimeo or iTunes. You know, stay tuned, but it'll be coming nearby soon. So it's out and it's done and it's good.
You had fun doing this.
I did. It was I learned a lot, and frankly, I think it probably got me my job. I showed it to the owner of the company I'm at working at now, and he goes, "Oh, it was a pretty good film." And then next thing I know, he's asking me to work for him. So.
Good for you. Who is Kalki?
Kalki is a prophecy from the Vedic Indian tradition. He's supposed to come at the end of this age and destroy the purveyors of lies. And he's, you know, what happens is they predict that things get so corrupt and so bad in this age that only help from a divine source can save us. And so Kalki comes on a white horse and destroys, you know, the Illuminati or the New World Order, I'm not sure, but, you know, the bad guys. And so I think he kills the Archons, actually, not kills them, destroys them. And destroys the Archons because we have no weapons to destroy them. Getting back to our original subject, and so Kalki is a myth that's about 6,000 years, depending on when you think these texts were finally copied over and what the oral traditions are. So I don't know, but it's some of the oldest mythologies on our planet, and some of the other avatars that have come through the Vedic tradition preceding Kalki are Krishna and the Buddha and Vishnu, you know, all these previous incarnations. So, some people think David Icke is Kalki, so maybe he is.
He might be.
Yeah, he might be.
He might be. You've been an expert into the late film director Stanley Kubrick. You've studied a lot. Did he die under mysterious circumstances?
Well, he died 666 days exactly before January 1st, 2001, which is the first day of the year of his most famous film, which I find a little disconcerting.
Yeah, there's no question. Now, tell me a little bit about the popular film The Shining. But there was a documentary called Room 237 about it, right?
That's right, yeah. Yeah, Room 237 is by my friend Rodney Asher. It's on Netflix. You can see it now. It's actually a really pretty good film. It's about The Shining and about all the theories that people have about The Shining. And I'm featured actually pretty heavily. Almost half of the film is me. And it approaches all these different interpretations of The Shining, including one jaw-dropping example where this filmmaker has taken The Shining and superimposed it so that the end and the is over the beginning and the beginning is over the end. In other words, the first frame of the film is he superimposes the last frame of the film, then runs the film backwards over the film, so you see the film backwards and forwards at the same time. And it's actually astonishing to watch because when Jack Nicholson is being interviewed by the head of the hotel and the hotel manager is telling him about, you know, the previous manager murdering, you know, his children, that Jack is trying to murder Danny at the end of the film, right? And it's like all these juxtapositions going on. You have to wonder if Kubrick, if he was even a, you know, smarter guy than we're actually thinking he was. So Room 237 is a really good example of how different people see a film made by a genius like Stanley Kubrick. But my thing is that all those theories that are presented in Room 237 merely support my theory that I'm presenting, because you know, one person says that it's about the Holocaust because of all the German insignia and things that are in the Shining. And I say, well, it's not really about the Holocaust. It's about the German scientists that were brought into NASA in the 50s. That's really what that's about. So my thing is actually supported by all the disparate theories presented in Room 237.
He was also, though, Kubrick was also working on Eyes Wide Shut when he died.
Yes, he just finished his first edit of it, yes.
He had called that the best film to date that he had ever done.
Yep. And then he didn't really get to finish it because he died, so it kind of got finished for him. And I think it needed him, not whoever finished it, to finish it.
I think you're right.
Yeah, it was not his best film because it needed another trim job on the edit, because it was just... There's certain tricks that directors use when they're trying to get actors to emote, and one of them is to repeat the line. So you'll say, I saw you at the party. You saw me at the party?
De Niro does that a lot.
Right. But a lot of times you'll clip those out on the last edit so the movie moves faster. And I think Kubrick meant to do that but didn't get his pass that he wanted because – you know, events overwhelmed him, and then he died, and we'll never know now.
We'll never know. What's the Brotherhood of Saturn, Jay?
The Brotherhood of Saturn. That's a very good question. The Brotherhood of Saturn is a secret society that came out of Germany. And there's a book called Fire and Ice, which describes their rituals and describes what they do. And ironically, in this book, Fire and Ice, the rituals, what the purpose of the Brotherhood of Saturn is almost exactly what happens to the astronaut in the movie 2001, A Space Odyssey. And the rituals of the Brotherhood of Saturn are almost exactly evoked by what happens in the orgy scene in Eyes Wide Shut. So my conclusion is that Stanley Kubrick, with his German wife, Christiana, and his German producer, Jan Harlan, had some kind of connection to this German secret society. I also believe that probably Wernher von Braun and Hermann Oberth and a lot of the other scientists that came in on Project Paperclip were part of the Saturn Brotherhood of Saturn, which would explain why they named the rocket the Saturn V. It's always kind of mystified me why the rocket that went to the moon was called the Saturn.
Well, that's a good point, too. Jay, when you do all this, and you've been involved in this spirituality and metaphysics for a long, long time, what pushes you? Where's your passion here?
Well, I'm trying to do the best I can to raise the consciousness of the human race, because I believe that we're in a race between that raising of consciousness and utter and complete disaster. And I want it to be the raising of consciousness. And so I'm willing to sacrifice quite a bit of my life to achieve that. And fortunately, in the 30 years that I've been doing it, I actually see it happening. And I'm not saying it's me, because I know there's a lot of people, you included, that are involved in this process of sacrificing a lot to try to raise the level here of the consciousness on our planet. And but I can see it happening, especially among the millennials. They truly are wide awake, and I think that we're seeing this change, and I think they know it. You know, Dick Cheney can't, you know, fly to Canada because he's afraid of getting arrested, and Eric Holder couldn't speak at a university the other day because they said, you know, you were doing Fast and Furious. Why should we have you here? And even Michelle Obama couldn't even speak at a college. People are waking up, and they're starting to find out that everybody that they thought were their friends and the politicians aren't really their friends at all, regardless of their party. And I think this is part of the waking up that's going to happen, and I think it's going to be hopefully a peaceful waking up, which is what I'm hoping for, which is what I'm trying to guide it as best I can towards.
It may not be a peaceful awakening, though.
It may not, and we have to be ready for that, too. Apparently, Homeland Security is ready for it.
Well, that's a good point.
Yeah.
They've been ready for it, so we will see what happens. I think in the long run, Jay, we're going to win out. I've always said that. I believe that, but it's going to be a bumpy road along the way.
Well, it is, and, you know, we just have to keep trying, because, you know, we're winning, and we just have to understand that you know, the waking up of the world is actually really happening, and it's all, we're all part of it, and every one of us is doing our part.
No question about it. Jay, give us your websites.
Yeah, it's you can sacredmysteries.com for all our great videos, and ShastaMovie.com for finding out about Shasta, and if you want to read all my free weirdo articles, jaywidener.com.
All right, Jay, we're going to take some phone calls with you next hour. Are you up for it? Jay Widener, our special guest. We will take some phone calls with him. And, of course, Jay, let me ask you this. You've also got a book out called Alchemical Cinema, right?
No, it's not done yet.
Oh, really? Okay.
No, but I've been working on it for years.
Well, let's speed it up, huh?
I will.
All right, Jay, we'll be back in a moment. We're going to talk about the Archons. Are they really out there? What are they trying to do? And if you've been to Mount Shasta and you want to share some stories about what's going on there, You can do that too when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM.